And with that, I'll open up for questions. But Wilson, I was wondering also if you could talk a little bit, mention how you could use the human rights system as well. But not yet. I'm just giving you a heads up for a talk. Do we have any questions? It's Friday afternoon. Let's see how awake people are. Yes, a question. Welcome. And please introduce yourself, and if you represent an organization, please name that too.
I wasn't supposed to talk. Well, talk anyways.
You couldn't just...
So my name is Martina Osander. I'm program director for My Rights, which is an NGO that works internationally with disability rights. And I'm also working with anti-discrimination in Sweden. And I like the discussion about intersectionality, but I'd like to take it further because it's not just being a woman and having an impairment. It's being an indigenous woman with an impairment, living in poverty. And there's, you know, maybe being homosexual. There's so many levels to it. And I think it's important to remember that. And I also think when it comes to donors and what donors can do to increase the debate and also increase the focus in programming is maybe to open up for grant recipients to really think about these intersectionalities, maybe not in form of discrimination, but in form of stigmatization, and how programming can prevent stigmatization wherever that operation is implemented. And I don't know from a legal perspective, so maybe that's a question for you, but obviously if there is an absence of legal frameworks, maybe it's easier to talk about stigmatization than discrimination, because that depends on discrimination grounds in said country. So how do you get around that? How do you get around being an actor trying to reduce stigmatization for various reasons or discrimination grounds, as we would call them in Sweden or maybe in England? And how do you do that in a country where those laws may not exist? So therefore, that may cause a problem with accountability if those laws are not there. So that's why I'm thinking, yes, discrimination, but what we're really trying to avoid is, yes, in legal terms, of course, but we're trying to have individuals not being stigmatized wherever they go, whether it's healthcare, education, and whatnot. And just on the topic of education, inclusive education in particular, I find it rather interesting what Paula said, because it's really important to not only look at the quantifiable measures of access and dropout rates and whenever you graduate, but actually look at how to quantify qualitative data. How do we look at the quality? Working with children with disabilities, they may be in schools, but the quality, they're not really learning. And that could be applied to the rich countries, but it's far, far worse. So if you are that girl in rural sub-Saharan Africa and you have that impairment, it's just really hard, because you might not even be communicating with your family, nor even less the school or the teachers, because you don't have access to sign language, for example. So that's just some of the challenges, and I think it's important to talk about them in terms of stigmatization and exclusion. But I'll leave the discrimination question to you, Wilson. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think we have time to actually take one question a little bit out of each. So if you'd like to comment a little bit about sort of where there's no existing regulation, and if stigmatization then is more helpful perhaps as a conversation.
Okay, law is everywhere. I mean, if you go to the international law, for instance, you're having that the Convention on the Rights of a Child and the Convention on the Against Discrimination on Women are the most ratified conventions. Even the Vatican has ratified them. So, I mean, there are more countries ratifying those two conventions than member states to the UN. So it gives you a picture of the importance of those conventions. But once again, you're right. When you talk about perhaps the issue is not about discrimination from the legal perspective, but stigmatization, because we're talking anyway in the dynamics of inclusion, exclusion. You are belonging to my team, you are not belonging to my team, so you should be treated differently. And there will always be some kind of inclusion, exclusion dynamics. So the point is, as regarded to the law, or to the legal philosophy packaging the whole idea of democracy, that what you have to achieve is actually that those differences and inclusion exclusions are at least in a tolerable level, that you can tolerate those kind of distinctions. This is why perhaps anti-discrimination laws do not cover whether a person should be admitted in a social club or not, but whether they should be admitted in a hospital or not. So when it comes to that, I would say that it depends. There is always some international law connected somehow to a national law allowing for fighting discrimination from the legal perspective, whether in court or outside the court. But I would like to answer and join into questions here, but which is the role of donors, which is the role of international community, of some other states, and which is the role of the law, or the human rights when it comes to discrimination. And I would say institutional response. When I was talking about the state, or every state, every country is having at least or majorly two different duties. One of them is promoting non-discrimination by several ways, including enacting legislation against discrimination, and the other one is enforcing that law. But once again, if you're there, you should be balancing the externalities. I mean, who are losing? Who are the people losing from your interventions, and who are the people winning? And whether this benefit is individual or is collective? Because if you're talking about, for instance, positive action for boosting the number of women accessing the labor market, perhaps it is just that you are changing the distribution of the labor force if you are not taking into consideration that perhaps the amount of jobs is limited. So, but institutional response, I mean, how the state is responding to each case of discrimination that state is being aware of. And I put you an example which is actually from reality. There is a state where there were two murders at the same time, at the same place. That state is having very good anti-discrimination laws. That state is even having some positive interventions against discrimination. It is having a high rate of impunity, and it's having reward policies for criminal cases. So that person, the first one, was a poor person who was murdered, and there was X reward. 1 week later, there was another person murdered at the same place, but that person was a rich tourist from the capital city, and then the reward was about, I don't know, 20 times that X. So it doesn't matter how much anti-discrimination, positive actions, or affirmative you are trying to promote and to enact, until you say, look, such as in the Piñata Party example, you should be acting this way, and then you are not acting that way yourself. So you are not creating the conditions for generating that very artificial but still very important attitude change for people to not act in a discriminative way, because you are doing that yourself as a state. So when it comes to education, when it comes to law enforcement, when it comes to affirmative actions, the way to do that from the human rights perspective would be that there is a need of strong institutional response, not only for promoting anti-discrimination, but just for combating discrimination, and that should start by the very state. Otherwise, you are giving the wrong message. And this is exactly what happens, and I promise that I'm finishing with that. States were signing the CEDAW Convention, the Convention Against Discrimination Against Women, and there where you're having some states saying, okay, I am going to promote anti-discrimination, I am going to promote non-discrimination on women, but then I'm making a reservation saying that I will not enforce any legal measure which is against our cultural patterns. And this was not only India or Nepal or North Korea, but also Belgium and Luxembourg, for instance. So this is a way of saying perhaps promotion is very good in the hope that someone is taking that from the moral point of view and they do not discriminate. But when it comes to enforcing or giving anti-discrimination teeth, so there is another story. So that's a very that's unlucky way of doing it, and that's the major concern. when you are having an institutional response, strong institutional response, clear institutional response, so all those attributes that play, that may play against you, you are black, you are a foreign, you are a refugee, you are a handicapped, you are whatsoever, there will always be something that's wrong about you. But when the law is treating you equally in order to make the system blind on that condition, then you are creating the conditions for social change.
Paula.
Now I can just add on, and I think that at the system level, the legal level is one part. We were doing a study last year in CEDA looking at gender inequalities and gender perspectives on dropout in the countries where we have programs with education. And it was quite clear three levels that had to be addressed. It was the legal system, the policy level, it was the individual household level, and it was the school, the community level. Mm-hmm. So whenever you do the changes, you have to see, depending on the context, where should you put the efforts in. And then I think the civil society, for example, have one part in actually promoting and putting inequalities higher up an agenda, and also the accountability part. Mm-hmm. The donor can only be a dialogue partner. It has to be the national ownership, the country itself that drives the change. But what takes place within the school is, it's a systematic approach. You need to have the policies, you need to have the curriculum, you need to have the updated textbooks, but at least, well, the most important is that you the teachers that operate within the school, they have the understanding, they have the knowledge, they have the resources to actually deal with things. We have, for example, in Cambodia, examples, so we have a very system-wide approach in the support. Together with all the donors, very coordinated, we see that here is a lack of, when it comes to child-friendly schools and disabled children. So then UNICEF are very good at that. So they are doing a targeted measure for disabled children, but within the systematic approach to see how it goes hand in hand. And I think that is to target specific parts within a system. But even if they have the legal possibilities, it's the people who operate within the system who has to really implement them. So they don't have the knowledge and understanding for it. I mean, nothing will really happen on the ground.
Thanks. Yeah, Pat. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead,
please. I was just thinking about what Wilson was saying about ratifying CEDAW and then perhaps not act upon it and so on. But I would like to add also, there is a symbolic value by doing those things. And I think, and I mean, we shouldn't be underestimated. And I think civil society organizations can act upon these ratifications, so to speak. And I think the big diffusion of gender quotas across the world is a very good example of that, where like the Beijing Declaration in 1995 was so crucial for transnational organizations and also like domestic civil society organizations to actually act on these declarations, so to speak. So I think although the government doesn't, you know, the intention is not that good, still actors can act upon them. So I think that, and then push for changes. So the symbolic value, I think, is important.
Any questions? Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Asif. I worked as a director for the Asian Development Bank before, and I worked for the UN DESA when we were developing the Sustainable Development Goals. And now I'm the principal consultant for the International Sustainable Development Resource Center, which is based in Geneva. So I spend most of my time between Geneva and Stockholm now. CEDA is doing a good job. I just had a chance last month to read one of the nice studies on all this inclusive education and disability on the country like China, which is very, very hard to work with in terms of policy and regulation. And I was amazed to read that, how they incorporated the business, the corporate world, the foundations, and the Save the Children, which is one leading organization, the backbone who written the CRC. And I was amazed to see how IKEA Foundation, H&M, Save the Children, they work so nicely, work together with the country, which is very hard to work, and they have a very nice successful model that can be transformed into perhaps a real policy decision. And I would request Paula to make a documentary with the CEDA help and share it with the world and in different forums. Mm-hmm. So we can adapt that model in other countries rather than doing more experiment in universities because the world is moving very fast.
Mm.
And these models are really, really very sustainable. And Save the Children has done a very marvelous job, and I see the ICA Foundation is doing a marvelous job, and the H&M, they work together, and it's a Swedish spirit that comes out, that the children and inclusive education and all this has to be working together.
Mm.
So I think CETA should spend some money to make a documentary and share it with the people of the world.
Good. A piece of advice for Paula. I won't let you comment because it will become too cheesy, I think.
Yeah.
That's fine, but thank you for those. Do we have any further questions? No. I'm wondering if the two of you would like to have any final comments before I try to wrap up a bit. And again, sort of from the conversations, and you will do a second phase, and I think that's good to... it will be. I look very much forward to if that comes about, sort of also to see, because now we spend quite a sort of the measurements that you've included in this report is very much from the sort of duty bearer side, the institutions and their the possibilities of acting within the sphere of their own political willingness. But I think what will be interesting is also to see when that demand comes from somewhere and if that could also be, and the whole attitude discussions that we've had as well, sort of how important it is to combine with attitudes. So that could be. But again, I'd like to, if you have any sort of reflections of the discussions, but also coming back to the fact that we obviously also work with discrimination in this country, but here we are sort of representing sort of a donor community. If you have any final recommendations that you'd like to provide to both actually civil society represented who also deal with these issues, but also, of course, the government of Sweden, including CETA. And then I'll try to wrap up.
Is that for me?
That was for you, of course, leaving...
I've just got one thing, which... it's not really what you asked for.
Really?
Because I think sometimes, you know, we can write nice reports... and we can have productive meetings like this.
Mm.
We can exchange views and talk about the difficulties and so on. But there is a shock value to some of what we're working on.
A shock value mm-hmm.
to some of what we're working on. I'm reminded of a documentary film I saw, and I've actually seen some situations that the documentary was made about, talking about mental health in Ghana, and the way that people with at least certain mental health problems are highly stigmatized, and they're chained up. They spend a lot of their life chained up. And I think, you know, we can... Sorry. By researching such issues, we can kind of neutralize some of this shock value. I think if you want to go for, clearly legislation could be part of dealing with that type of situation, but you also need leadership. You need leadership from national leaders. You need local opinion formers. You need the disabled people's organizations to act on these issues. And, I think it's going to be very interesting if we get to the second phase and we do look at social movements and civil society organizations. And I deliberately pick this example because I think that, in the disability movement has made many great achievements, and the way in which disability is now considered at the very highest levels of development. But there are still enormous gaps there that are absolutely not being addressed, and it's very sobering. I just wanted to inject that element of in a sense of shock and of the depth of challenge of some of these issues. You know, if you don't have in that context, if you don't have religious leaders, witch doctors working with you on that issue, you're not going to make much progress. It's a really complex set of issues.
It is, absolutely. Rachel, did you want to add anything?
No, I'll let
you have the first. Okay. Do you have
Okay, should I
if you want, absolutely. Okay. You saw that. you looked eager, and there's time.
I think the whole issue of leave no one behind is something that needs to be discussed much further. Mm. And it has so many different angles of it. And it's quite a new ambition as well. It wasn't the same ambition in the Millennium Development Goals. It's a new ambition. I think different countries interpret it in different ways. What does it actually mean?
Mm.
Both at partner countries and also among other donor countries. Mm. What does it mean in practice? So that is something that I think we have to continue to discuss. What does it mean in practice for the work?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not discriminating anyone.
I think my final words is going to be about these kind of like general recommendations about having like broader programs. Rachel was writing in the report, and I think, and we've also been talking about that. And I think that's crucial. We need that kind of like fundament, so to speak. But I also want to also add and emphasize that I think there is a future also for targeted measures in some cases. And I think it's in those cases where you have strong structures that are like working to maintain status quo, so to speak, and to because there are like power symmetries in society, and where you have these strong forces working to maintain status quo, I think we sometimes need these more like targeted pushes to really make change. So I think I agree with the general recommendation, but I think we must understand the complexities, and that sometimes we need those add-ons, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I have a very split view on the one hand, thinking that, as I've said in the presentation, that you know, for much discrimination, broad-based inclusive services are vital to get there, but and also that you know, perhaps in terms of changing social attitudes, that human rights-based campaigns that appeal to ideas of equality and everyone's innate rights may be better than sort of very specific ones that point to particular forms of discrimination. And then I thought about Andrew's example, and sometimes it needs to be shocking and it needs to really focus in on a particular kind of discrimination and really challenge people to say and make them think, you know, I'm doing that, I need to stop. So I also think both approaches are needed, and the balance will depend very much in a particular situation on a particular issue.
Mm. Your evidence also gives legitimacy to that sort of, there's as always, it's contextual. Wilson, last words.
Just stressing one of the conclusions of a report, or some of the conclusions of a report, saying that there should be comprehensiveness in anti-discrimination approach, and that sustainability should be one of the, I don't know, evident goals within every single approach. And in that sense, I would, of course, push for more attention to the legal perspective, not when creating or enacting laws, but when implementing them or enforcing them, not from the anti-discrimination perspective, but from the general administration of justice. Because, I don't know, as it was stated in Anna Karenina, this famous Russian book, every happy marriage are looking like each other because they are having the same balance, or all bits are in the right balance, but each unhappy marriage is unhappy their own way or its own way. It means that it just takes one thing, one little part, not to be correct or at the right amount or the right level, just to throw it or any progress away. So I would say that is something that I liked in the report, the comprehensiveness in the conclusions.
Mm. Thank you for that. We'll wrap up. Thank you for also staying with us until 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. It's not evening yet, it's still afternoon. I'll take with me sort of the, which I think is broader than anti-discrimination measures alone, but the whole issue of supporting institutions, public institutions, that are able to meet the rights and needs of all its people. And that, I think, what was also perhaps interesting could be discussed further is also the duty bearer's responsibility, not only in sort of the formal decision-making, but also right until the meeting, the teachers, the health service providers, because that's where the meeting actually exists, where the people would meet the duty bearers, and therefore that also the health workers, the teachers, are responsible for the implementation of existing policies, sort of, and that, I think, particularly in the field that I work in, when it comes to providing services such as abortion or services to people representing different groups, and especially lesbian and gay people that I started off with, sort of that meeting is highly representative of how people experience discrimination and beyond legislation, I have to say. It's also this difficulty of seeing the long-term effects. I mean, the question is there a linkage between anti-discrimination measures and poverty reduction, basically? And that difficulty, because most of the studies that you captured within your study did not see that long-term, so we still have that question to look at. Sort of, we could see that different anti-discrimination measures will work well or not, but for the purpose of reducing discrimination. But the long-term effect is still sort of something that we could look further into. Context I've written seems to be something that I write in all my summaries, but it's probably because it's very true. And also the link, if institution is one thing, the link of norms in society, in this case in particular, sort of where we need to find that balance, which I think of, obviously, that's a national ownership and a combination of grassroots activities. And the intersectional perspective. I'll end with those intersectional, the word, and let us talk about that in particular further and what that means in practice for us. So with that, thank you very much to all of you, and thank you for coming and joining us. I have one more thing. We do have a lot of seminars, as I mentioned, and if you are interested, CEDA are hosting our next seminars on Wednesday, March 8 at 11 at CEDA, where we'll launch the report Animal Health and Development and its Role for Poverty Reduction and Human Welfare by Ulf Magnusson from SLU and Arvid Uggla SLU and Jonathan Rushton, University of Liverpool. Please register now if you are interested in also attending that, and have a good weekend.